speak to us on class number two, be perfect.
Okay, we left off at the last class with this question of what kind of mountain we are being called to, what kind of mountain we see ourselves at, and that we're talking about a religion of character attributes rather than specific rules and regulations. And yet, paradoxically, the rules and regulations are somehow an integral part of the whole thing. And we saw the ninth beatitude of washing people's feet as this combination of a character attribute that turns into a behavior, and that is the source of blessing. But we had an unfinished business of this statement. Unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. There's a lot of absolute statements in the Sermon on the Mount, and this is one of them. The dilemma for us is how on earth could we possibly ever be more righteous than the Pharisees? These are professionals. They dedicate their life. They have extensive training. They submit to all kinds of rigor. And we are told that, not good enough. You got to do better than that if you have any hope of getting into the kingdom. So this next section is a fascinating section. There's an exhortational dimension to it, and there's a technical dimension to it. And I can't help but dive into the exhortational side of it a little bit first. So we'll look at the first two. You shall not kill, interestingly, one of the Ten Commandments. And the second one is you shall not commit adultery, another one of the Ten Commandments. And the first point that Jesus brings up is that human relationships are at the core of righteousness. The very first point he brings up is one about how you get along. And he starts with thou shalt not kill, but the fundamental question of can we walk along together and be harmonious with each other. He mentions that if you're going to give your gift at the altar, and in Judaistic religion, that's a pretty important thing. You know, taking the money in, the gift at the altar, that's a really important religious action. And Jesus says, actually, reconciling with someone else is more important than any formal religious action that you can take. Freeze that thought. It's not that you shouldn't do that, that's all great, but if you're prioritizing your formulaic religion over just getting along with people, you've got it backwards. Go, get along with people, and then let's take our gift to the altar. And it's another fascinating thing that he says, if anybody has aught against you, it's not even sorting out the people that you're upset with. It's trying to track down the people who are upset with you and finding some way of repairing the breach, which is very challenging, as we'll find as we look through each of these sections. Thou shalt not commit adultery. He says, pluck out your eye. Now again, anybody who wants to take the Bible fully literally is in trouble, or they are not following this commandment. But what can we take from it as an exhortation? It's a drastic action. These problems of anger and lust are deadly problems in human relationships. And if you see that this problem is developing in your life, don't take it lightly. You've got to take absolutely serious measures of getting out of your life whatever the thing is that is leading you down the wrong path. Okay. And we know this in research nowadays about addiction, or even if any of you have tried dieting, right? They say, if you're trying to have a diet and you have a whole bunch of chocolates in your closet, or in the cupboard, you're going to fail, right? You have made failure too easy. You can't trust yourself to stick to your own commitments, even on something as trivial as a diet. You cannot trust yourself. So what do you have to do? In your moment of strength, when you have that passion for the objective, you've got to restructure your environment. Get the chocolates out of the house. Cut off that thing from your life that you know that when you're in a bad state, it's going to pull you down. And be drastic about it, right? Cause and effect. In both of these cases, we have lust and we have anger and we have consequences that come from them. And they start so little and at the end turn into a massive amount of destruction in our lives. And we find this in James. He talks about how great a forest is set alight by a small fire. So these are precursors. Okay, anger is a precursor to killing, and lust is a precursor to adultery. We've got to worry about the precursors. And this is a different way of looking at law, right? The Pharisees are just like, did I kill anybody today, or did I commit adultery today? That's it. I'm done my religious thinking for the day. Jesus is saying, it's a whole lot more complicated than that. Okay? There's a whole spectrum of options, and you need to focus on those. Now, okay, so these are the core relationship issues. Slippery slopes are real. Our words matter, right? What do you call people? Do you call people names? Our relationship should be ahead of our offering to God, and we should be willing to take drastic action to protect ourselves. So now let's come back to this technical question of how on earth can I be more righteous than the Pharisees? And so Jesus begins by comparing what Moses says versus what he says. So again, it's not coincidental that he starts with the Ten Commandments. But he does something we totally don't expect, because we know it's hard to follow the law. So Jesus says, I've got a solution for you. We're really hoping that he's going to give us a goal that is easier than following the law. And in fact, Jesus does exactly the opposite. Right? We were trying to get away from the Mosaic law, and yet Jesus says, you have to go way beyond what the law says in order to actually be righteous. Not killing people, not good enough. You got to start with what kind of names you're calling people, and whether you're even angry with people. Do you have unresolved conflicts? That's where righteousness lives. And absolute statement. Everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable. Everyone. And if we go through the audience here and we take an informal poll, who has ever been angry with his brother? Okay, and if we sifted our numbers on the basis of this commandment of Christ, there'd be very few of us left. Everyone who looks at a woman with lust has committed adultery. If we sifted through our numbers and weeded out everybody who had lusted in some capacity, we'd have very few numbers left. So it's challenging for us that Jesus begins essentially with universal condemnation. We thought we were in trouble with the Pharisees. Now it's even harder. Why is he doing that? Well, the point that Jesus is trying to drive home is that keeping the law is not synonymous with righteousness. Okay, there's a place for law and there's a use for law, and it means something, but it doesn't actually mean righteousness. So you can keep the law of you shall not kill and not be righteous. That is not an indicator of righteousness. It's a useful piece of information. It's a useful guidance. But true righteousness, actual righteousness, is not directly related to keeping the law. And I'm a computer guy, so I had to put a computer slide up. But what he's saying is that sin or righteousness is not binary. Now, when we talk about binary in computers, we mean you have only two values. You have a one or a zero. It's on or it's off. It's true or it's false. There's no gray area, right? And this is the legal and the pharisaical approach to righteousness. I am either righteous or I am not righteous. You either killed somebody or you didn't kill somebody. And if you did kill somebody, you're good. And if you did, you're bad. And it's very easy. And what Jesus is saying, no, righteousness is somewhere on a path in this direction. But at any given time, you might be either closer to the darkness or closer to the light. But it's an analog value. You can be more and less righteous. And how many personal conflicts do you have in your life today? Well, you want to lessen that. And the path to righteousness is to have fewer personal conflicts, but don't have the illusion that by Tuesday of next month, you'll have, done that one. Move on to the next one, which is very challenging for us. So, Jesus is freaking us out a little bit here by requiring us to be more righteous than the Pharisees. He makes the law even more stringent, because what the Pharisees were doing is apparently too easy. So we have to ask ourselves an interesting question. Is Jesus establishing a new law? Is he basically setting up a different legal framework? Right? In other words, the Ten Commandments said, thou shalt not kill. And is Jesus basically saying, well, the problem with the Ten Commandments was the words that were written, on commandment number 4. It should have actually said, you shall not, offend your brother. And the challenge with that is in Deuteronomy chapter 12, it says, everything that I command you, you shall be careful to do. You shall not add to it or take from it. One of the laws of Moses is that you don't add to the laws of Moses. And so Jesus is coming along, and is he adding to the laws of Moses? Imposing new requirements that are not there under the legal structure. It says in Romans, the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has made me free from the law of sin and death. Why was the law of Moses the law of sin and death? Was the problem with the law of Moses simply that they were the wrong laws? We could have started this whole process 1,500 years earlier if Moses had come down the mountain with a different set of rules. But in Romans 8:3, it says, what the law could not do, weak as it was through the flesh. So what does that tell us? There is, in fact, a problem with law and with the law of Moses. But what Romans tells us is the problem with the law of Moses is people, is the flesh. It's not that the rules are the problem, it's the people that live the rules. And if Jesus is bringing in a new law, what hasn't changed? We're still people, right? It's still the same flesh that was there in the desert 3,500 years ago. We're still the same kind of people, the same basic DNA pools, right? So what's going on here? Is the law against the promises of God? Certainly not. If there had been a law, if, hypothetically speaking, there had been a law given which could have given life, truly righteousness would have been by the law. Right? If there was a code that could be written that would encapsulate righteousness, it would have been written. And that's what the law of Moses would have been. And by inference, there is no codification that can adequately define righteousness. So the codifications that we have are useful, and they're informative, and they're good, but they do not define righteousness. And this is where we start to get a hint on how on earth can we be more righteous than the scribes and the Pharisees. Well, one of the things we do is we change the definition of righteousness. We start to understand righteousness on a different scale. So I propose to you the commandments of Christ, the things that we're reading this morning, are not just a new law of Moses. We can't take the whole structure of how the law of Moses worked and substitute the words and then carry on with the Mosaic framework of religion, enforcing the commandments of Christ just as we would the commandments of the that were written on the tables of stone. If we do, we miss the point. We've totally missed the point. And in fact, what Jesus is doing here is tying heavier and heavier burdens on us. If we take that approach to this chapter, and we'll see that Jesus does an awesome way of breaking us fully of that illusion by the time we get to the end of this chapter. So it's crucial for us to understand that the information that Jesus is giving us in this chapter is not a new Mosaic law. He's trying to explain to us what true righteousness is. So let's look at the next section. Basically, he argues against divorce, which is a little bit surprising for the Jews in the audience, because divorce is permitted under the law. Right? Thou shalt not kill, that's a prohibition under the law. Thou shalt not commit adultery, that's a prohibition under the law. And along comes divorce, and divorce is actually allowed under the law. And there's another interesting thing about this one, and you read the verses this morning. Of the sections that we've read, there's seven of them. How many of them do you think are impossible to actually fully keep? Okay, and if you go through in your head and start thinking, can I actually never be angry? Am I never going to lust? Am I going to be true to my word every single time, always? No. Am I never going to seek revenge? Probably not. Am I going to love my enemies fully, always? No. Am I going to be perfect as God? No. So we have seven, and this one, am I going to get divorced? No. That one, I'm okay with. That one, I'm clear. I'm never going to get divorced. Now that's kind of odd. It should raise our interest that this one is different. And the reason it's different is because it's not different. In the Jewish culture of the time, divorce was the foundation of marriage. Okay? To the point where when Jesus in a different chapter says, oh, you really shouldn't be getting divorced, they go, well, wait a minute. If we can't have divorce, we can't have marriage. Right? The two of them, the only reason a marriage could possibly exist is if when I'm done with it, I can sign a legal document and move on to my next partner. That is the way the world works, right? And so for them to hear that you should not divorce would have been as impossible in their culture as all the other items that we had in our list. It was just assumed that divorce is a fabric of society, and that if you don't have access to divorce, you shouldn't even bother getting married. So what is Jesus proving with this point? Well, you can keep the law and not be righteous. That's what he's been saying for all the other ones. Thou shalt not kill. You can keep that law and not be righteous. Thou shalt not commit adultery. You can keep that law and not be righteous. Okay? You can divorce. Yeah, you can keep that law and not be righteous. If the point of your divorce is a convenient way to switch partners, that's adultery. The fact that you've signed a legal document, you know, the fact that you put some words on a piece of paper, don't change the moral value of your action, right? If your intent is to switch partners, then it doesn't matter what the paperwork says. I don't care, Jesus says. You can do whatever legal thing you want. If your intent is wrong, it's wrong. Right? You can follow the law and not be righteous. This is what Jesus is trying to drill in again and again and again. And this one, you know, if I can pause for a second, when we fail in our community on six of the seven of these items, you know, are we consistent in how we help each other recover? And just throw that out there, that I think we should be consistent, that when we fail on each of these things, we should help each other recover in the same way. Keeping the law is not righteousness. Okay, next one. You shall not swear falsely. How powerful is our word? When we agree to something, how firm is our commitment? Now, it's not surprising that this comes immediately after a discussion of marriage, because there's one of those cases where you said you were going to do something, right? You said you were going to stick with this partner for the rest of your life. How powerful was that commitment? And the question for me, you know, when you buy a house, you put in an offer, and your offer has a certain number of subject to's. Yes, I'm going to buy the house as long as item one, item two, item three, item four. And the question for me is, how many subject to's do you have on your commitments to God? How many subject to's do you have in your commitments to your partner and to your family and to your community? Yes, I'm going to be a servant of this ecclesia as long as, right? Yes, I'm getting married. And the thing is, we're all We all fail in this respect. We all have subject twos. This is part of what Jesus is. I get married and I'm going to, you know, be married forever. There's subject twos way back there. I don't know everything that's going to happen. And so where is the path to righteousness here? The path is to try to cross as many subject twos out of our life as we can. You know, are you committed to faithfully attending this meeting even when people are mean to you, for instance, or maybe ignore you, or they put forward policies that bug you? Is that a subject two? You know, is your service to God based on certain criteria that must be fulfilled? You know, your friendships, your service to other people in the community? Well, as long as you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. But this section of oaths, we don't really talk it up very much. We don't make a very big deal about our yes being yes and our no being no. And I suspect it's because in our culture, the value of yes being yes has diminished. It's like the farming community still have it, where they'll make a big deal and they'll shake hands on it, and that's done, right? You don't have to have big legal documents, but because their yes is their yes and their no is their no, and they live and they die by it. And we have to kind of go back to that way of thinking. One analogy that came to my mind is if you sell pizzas, right, and somebody comes to you and says, I want to buy a pizza, and you say yes, and you take their money, and you say yes, and then you don't deliver a pizza, or you only deliver a pizza half the time, or you deliver half of a pizza, we would consider that a form of stealing, right? I gave you the money, and you didn't give me the thing that we agreed to. Well, we do this with our word all the time, right? Somebody, are we going to see you there on Sunday? Yes. Subject to A, B, C, D. So when we say that yes, we get the money. We get the payback of being a positive, agreeable person, right? We get to say yes, and we get all the benefits of that. But when it comes to fulfilling our yes, well, half the time we do and half the time we don't. And, of course, our children know this about us. And we kids ask us for something, and we say no. And they keep pestering us. And they pester us, and they pester us. Why? You know those rotten kids? They're actually very wise. They've learned that our no didn't actually mean no. It means no approximately 80% of the time. So hope springs eternal, so they're going to keep working on that 20% to turn that no into a yes. So our no is not no, our yes is not yes. And so what we find if we try to live with our yes truly being yes and our no truly being no, we stop saying them so often, right? If when I say yes, I'm going to do everything to my dying breath to make sure that happens, I'm going to say yes if I can. You know, I'm going to start putting qualifiers on there, explaining these subject to, laying them out up front. It's not dishonest if we lay it out up front. You know, I'm going to come this Sunday if I feel like it. Right? That's not going to go over as well. You're not going to get as much payback, right? Social payback if you say that. But if that's actually what's going to happen, if that's actually how you're going to unfold on Sunday morning, that is a more honest way to carry your conversation out. The other aspect of oaths that Jesus points out is how little we control, right? So in their culture, they would swear by heaven, and that's got to be a big yes, because we're swearing by heaven, and heaven's huge. But then Jesus says, or by the earth, or by Jerusalem, or by my head, you know, and it's like you would gauge your swearing by how committed you were to actually doing what you said. And Jesus is saying, you have so little control. You're under such an illusion that all these things have any effect on your decision at all. Right? Be aware you can't even make your head white or black, or the hairs of your head white or black. So be a little humbler about your yeses and your no. Yes, I'll try to. You know, and if I'm not safe even then going, am I really going to try to, or am I just trying to get them off my case? You know, it's a challenging thing, a simple thing, yet very challenging. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Religion gets, or the law of Moses gets a bad knock for this one. where they go, it's so savage, and Mahatma Gandhi is famous for kind of going, well, then the whole world will be blind, and the whole world will be toothless. But in a historical context, what the law of Moses is saying is that your eye is just as valuable as my eye. It's really just a statement of universal human equality, which is unheard of in the ancient world. It's only heard of in the last few hundred years, really, in the entire history of mankind. The notion that anybody's eye is equally valuable as anybody else's? Ridiculous, right? The king's eye is worth at least 1,000 peasants' lives, right? And the nobleman, and the employer versus the employee, and the men versus women. Like, there's been all kinds of different standards of value in the history of mankind. And the law of Moses comes and says, it's a human being. It's a human eye. If you've cost somebody a human eye, I don't care whose human eye it is, it's the same price. Okay, and it was never interpreted in the sense of literally going and taking out people's eyes. It was always understood as the value, the loss. You're making good the loss. So if somebody lost a tooth, you better make good on that loss. And no matter who you are, you're equal. But in here we have one of these very difficult statements where it says, do not resist the one who is evil, as part of this eye for an eye section. And very difficult to understand completely precisely how to live that, right? This is one of these gray area ones where I think it takes a lifetime to pin that down. Clearly, Paul objected to Peter and resisted him when he was sort of promoting an incorrect doctrine. And there's different examples where righteous people have resisted and other examples where they haven't. And we have to walk through there and try to decide when we're resisting evil, are we doing it in the way God intends and for God's purposes and not just for our own purposes, you know, to seek vengeance for ourselves. And this 1 Peter 3:9, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing. What did we start with? We started with the Beatitudes, with blessings, giving a blessing instead. When negativity comes your way, you have a weapon against it, and it's blessing. For you were called for the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing. Okay, so we can turn things around. We don't have to pay back in the same manner. We don't have to behave the way that people are behaving towards us. That's liberating, right? We have an animal nature that wants to just respond in kind. And Jesus is saying there's a divine nature that says respond differently. Respond better than the animal nature would. And as an aside, this is kind of what we talked about being merciful early. Injustice creates room for mercy and forgiveness. So in a community where there was no injustice, there would be no forgiveness, and there would be no mercy. So our community's opportunities to show God's character would be very limited. So we should be thankful that there are people upsetting each other, right, in this group. Because the more that happens, the more opportunities you have to forgive and to be merciful, right? Keep that in mind. Injustice is a source of, is an opportunity to demonstrate God's character. And if we make it even, if we make it payback, then God's character never had a chance to show up there. The only time God's character has a chance to show up is when it's unfair, which is challenging to live. Love your neighbor, hate your enemy. Now, this is an interesting one because he's quoting from the law. Love your neighbor, it says in the law. Hate your enemy, that's not in the law of Moses. Where did that come from? And so what happens is you take a scriptural principle that says love your neighbor, and you start making logical conclusions based on it. Well, if the law says that I should love my neighbor, then naturally what the law means is if you're my enemy, I should hate you. Right? And the reason I point that out is because we have to be very careful when we start assuming that we know where a certain principle leads. If the Bible says love your neighbor, we're always safer sticking with the love your neighbor and not necessarily adding on the, well, therefore it must mean this and this and that, therefore I'm going to do that. It's always a little bit dangerous when you go down that road. And of course, the Good Samaritan is an example of that, where even though he was, you know, there was animosity between these two groups, the Good Samaritan is prepared to serve the Jewish men. And it talks about this is a behavior of God. Every morning, you know, the sun rises. There's beautiful sunrises and there's beautiful sunsets. And the world is full of good and bad people, and they all get to see those beautiful sunsets. Right? There's all kinds of good things that God puts out there for whoever. I'm just going to put the blessing out there, and anybody who wants to avail themselves of it, they can take it. I'm not going to set preconditions on beautiful sunsets. Right? That you can't see a beautiful sunset if you're a bad person. And he makes it rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Right? So, if we want to be more like God, we need to be less discerning in our generosity. Our generosity should be broader to any human being, and we should leave it up to God to make the distinctions. Now, there's a pattern that's kind of unfolding here, right? We've gone through six items so far, and it was, you have heard that it was said, and I say to you, and we have to ask ourselves, is this pattern true only of the six things that Jesus has pointed out so far? Or is he saying, this is a different way of thinking about rules? And I propose to you that Jesus isn't just cherry picking six incorrect commandments that need some corrections, right? He's saying, there's a different way of looking at law and rules. There is a way that says there's a minimum requirement, and then there's an infinity of possible righteousness that you can follow up with. And we can pursue this in other commandments, tithing, right? He says 10% you should give to God. So, and if you're taking a Pharisaical view, as I'm going to work, and I'm going to hit 10%, and when I'm 10%, I'm righteous. 9.5%, I was not righteous. 10%, I'm righteous. How would we apply this principle? Well, Jesus would say, you keep going, right? If you can find it in your generosity to give 10% of your income to good causes, that's great. And if you can do 11%, that's greater. And if you can do 12%, that's greater. And it's an interesting thing about the law is that it illuminates us, but sometimes it limits us. If you think of athletes running in the Olympics, okay, there's the 100-meter dash, and they run, and they give it all they've got, and then they cross the line, and what do they all do? They stop. It's like they put all that effort to just get to that line, and as soon as they were on the other side of the line, stop, race is over, right? We can do the exact same thing with law, right? We put all this effort to get just on the other side of the line, and as soon as we're past whatever line we've drawn in our head, we're like, oh, we're righteous, and now I can kick back and relax. And as long as I can hover above that line, I'm doing all right. The same thing goes for the Sabbath, for instance, right? Sabbath is supposed to take 15% of your time and make sure it's dedicated to God. Well, 15%, that's a starting point. What would Jesus say about that? Right? You can do more than that if you want. There is room for righteousness beyond that. So there's all these extrapolations, other places we can take this principle. And Jesus comes along and gives us the seventh one, which is the extrapolation to end all extrapolations. You, therefore, must. This is a requirement. You, therefore, must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. So if you somehow made it through six of these sections, thinking to yourself, Yeah, this is harder than the law of Moses, but I can do that. And this is harder than the law of Moses, but I can do that. And if you somehow deceived yourself into thinking that you could still check all the boxes, Jesus adds the little one at the end that makes sure you can't get out of this chapter thinking that righteousness is going to be about checking boxes. You can't. Because this box, this required box, you know and I know that you're never going to check that box. And we've got to pause there and go, well, what does that mean for all the other boxes? Our religion, our whole definition of righteousness can't be about drawing lines and checking boxes anymore. And the thing is, we use the phrase in our community, God manifestation, and I'm cautious on it because it's not in the Bible. We talked about that before, but this is God manifestation. If we want to find the scriptural basis, it's like, here is your challenge, is to be as perfect as God. This is the encapsulation of everything. John chapter 1:17, the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth were realized through Jesus Christ. The law cannot encapsulate righteousness the way that Jesus can. Now here's a map of a part of Israel, and this is the Philistine territory, and over here is Israel, but I've done something with Photoshop, and that's the dregs of it right there. I've gotten rid of the line, right? What happens when we don't draw a line? What happens if we don't know whether we're in the Philistine territory or whether we're in Israelite territory? Well, it only matters if you're trying to live along the edge, right? If you're deep here in Gaza, well, you know you're in Philistine territory. Now, the line's kind of not very important. You got to get out of there. And if you're way over here in Israel, you know the Philistine territory right over there, then the line doesn't matter to you then either. So it turns out that the line has some usefulness, but it's very limited usefulness, and it's limited to when you're trying to walk right along the line. And Jesus is saying that's not honest righteousness, right? You've got to do better than that. So we have this shades of gray, and we want to move from unrighteousness to righteousness, and this is how we tend to view our religion. There is some threshold somewhere, and we all in our heads keep it differently, that when I get over this threshold, I'm good, and I'm going to be in the kingdom, and if I happen to be here, then I feel bad, and I'm not going to be in the kingdom, and I'm going to be in the kingdom, and I'm not going to be in the kingdom, and based on the events of a given day, or a given week, or a given year, we jump back and forth, and it's not the way it works, is what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying we all have unrighteousness in us, and we're all trying to consistently move to being as righteous as God, and we're going to try to do that every day of our life till the day that we die. And I'd like you to turn to Mark chapter 10. Starting at verse 17, and this you'll probably be familiar with, there's the rich young man that comes to Jesus. And as he was setting up out on a journey, a man ran up to him and knelt before him and began asking him, "Good teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" So he's asking, where is the line? Right? What shall I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus doesn't know that that's where he's going yet. So he says, well, why do you call me good? No one is good except God alone, which is interesting. Maybe Jesus does know where he's going. But he says, you know the commandments. Do not murder. Do not commit adultery. Do not steal. Do not bear false witness. Do not defraud. Honor your father and your mother. Okay, that's, again, Jesus is in favor of the law. He agrees with the principles that are put forward. And somebody comes to him and says, how can I be a better person? And Jesus says, oh, here's a good starting point for you. I'll give you a list. And then the rich man says to him, teacher, I have kept all these things from my youth up. So, this guy is saying, I'm up here. And looking at him, Jesus felt a love for him, which is a fascinating statement on its own, because you go, did Jesus love everybody? But something about this young man and his eagerness struck a chord, an emotional chord with Jesus, and he looks at him and goes, man, I love you. And he says to him, one thing you lack, go and sell all you possess and give to the poor, and you shall have treasure in heaven, and come, follow me. And at these words, his face fell, and he went away grieved, for he was one who owned much property. So Jesus loves this man so much that he utterly crushes him. Isn't that interesting, right? He comes in, I've done the commandments, I've done all this stuff. And Jesus goes, man, you have got the wrong understanding of righteousness. Right? You're looking for a line so that you can kind of go, yeah, I made it. And this whole journey of righteousness isn't about saying I've made it. It's about always pushing further. And so Jesus says, you want righteousness? You know, let's get rid of that line for you. And we'll put it right up here where God is. And he crushes him. And so, what is Jesus doing for us here this morning in Matthew chapter 5? He's crushing us too. Right? He's putting all kinds of goals that we know we cannot reach on our own. And Jesus is trying to say, make sure your religion isn't about crossing imaginary lines. Make sure your religion is about seeking perfection. It's about seeking God, and that's a lifelong task. And in the words of Kipling, it says, fill each unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run. Now, why would we do it if not to cross the line? Where do we get the motivation in the morning to go further if there's not some line that we're going to say, yay, I crossed, you know, I got 10 kingdom points today. That's better than yesterday. I only got 8, you know. And I think, for me, it's the profound belief that better is always better than worse. Okay, so better, as defined by God, is always better than worse. And so when you get up in the morning, you have a choice to make. What are you going to do today? Are you going to try to be better than yesterday or not? And why would you try to be better? It's not to get kingdom points. It's not to cross a line. It's not to be able to brag about something. It's not because it's going to make you in or out or because of a fear. It's because you believe in God that he's got a better way of living. And if he's got a better way of living and you agree with him, why wouldn't you try to live that way? Every day. Always, forever, and finding new and more challenging ways to reach that. And this, I think, is the blessing of this chapter, that there are no boundaries. We thought that the law was a boundary that kept us out of the kingdom, and Jesus is kind of thinking, no, there are no boundaries to your righteousness. You can pursue righteousness till the day you die, and you'll never get there, but it's an absolute noble pursuit, and it's a privilege to be part of that pursuit.